something just said, any luck getting those gospel songs you wrote 30 years out?
Musician and trucker Long Haul Paul joins us to talk about his latest album in this encore edition of Pop of Culture.
And our very own Jen Blackmer tells us what she's working on and where she's been.
What directors do is they are, I like to describe a director as sort of a navigator and a conduit for all of the different aspects of the production process.
Coming up,
Pop of Culture on IPR is made possible in part by Psi Iota Xi. Additional support comes from the Indiana Arts Commission, the Community Foundation of Randolph County, the National Endowment for the Arts, and sustaining members of IPR. You can support local programming today at indianapublicradio.org.
From IPR, this is Pop of Culture. I'm Michelle Kinsey.
And I'm Kara Duquette. We're two of the co-hosts of Pop of Culture, along with Jen Blackmer,
who's been conspicuously absent from the airwaves for the last few weeks. Our producer, Luke Jones, tracked her down.
Hi, Jen.
Luke, hi.
Hi, it's so good to see you.
I've been missing, I hear.
You have been missing, and I'm just going to start by asking you the question that you usually ask of our guests. What are you working on?
What am I working on? It feels like I have been missing and I've missed my Pop of Culture family so much. But I am working on a production of a play for the Department of Theater and Dance here at Ball State in our Strother Studio Theater. And this is actually the last production that is going to be mounted in that theater before we get our new Performing Arts Center, which
That's
is coming
right.
up. So to be the final director in that space is a real honor. And the play we're doing is called POTUS by Selena Fillinger. And it is indeed what you think it might be.
President of the United States?
Exactly. Yeah, POTUS, the acronym for President of the United States. Which is timely for so many reasons, but what I'll say is that it is a satire. It was actually written in 2022, and the play has been produced everywhere. I mean, it's been on Broadway. It had Vanessa Williams and Rachel Dratch were two of the names you might know who are in the Broadway production, and it has been produced at colleges and universities everywhere and a lot of smaller theaters around the country. So it's been incredibly popular. Again, I think because it's timely.
So let's start at the beginning. When you decide this is the play that we're doing, you have the script, you're the director. How do you go from a binder to the production that is premiering, I believe, Friday night.
Yeah, tonight. I can't believe it's here already. So I have been actually working on this show and thinking about this show now for months. And what directors do is they are, I like to describe a director as sort of a navigator and a conduit for all of the different aspects of the production process. So the director is responsible for casting the show. Obviously, we went through a whole audition process, and then the director is also responsible for being the primary source of communication with the designers who will be working on the set and the costumes and the lights and the sound and all of the major areas of the show. And so you as director are the script interpreter, the script understander, I guess, for lack of a better word. But there are certain aspects of the script that a director really feels strongly about illuminating through the production, right? So when designers have ideas, we want to make sure that those ideas for costume, sets, lights, sound all live in the same world, right?
Yeah.
So that it makes sense in the moment, which is, I'll say that with a little asterisk, because this play is a farce. And because of that, it is funny and bawdy and crazy. And in the second act in particular, no spoilers, but things kind of go off the rails. So The big question then is, you know, when they go off the rails, does it make sense how they go off the rails? So all of the choices that the designers make sort of get coordinated with the director. And then the director also leads rehearsals, working with the actors and making sure that the choices that they make also live inside that world.
Yeah. When you're doing a farce or a satire, and this is a difficult question, but does it feel funny when you're doing it?
Oh, wow. It's difficult because something that feels funny in the moment might not have staying power.
Yeah.
Right? And then when you begin to invite in an audience, the areas that they find funny might not be the ones that you thought they would, right? So there are moments in the script, in particular this script, because the playwright is actually a television writer. So it's got that same sort of feel to it, right? It moves really quickly. And so there are some things in the script that by their nature are just naturally funny. But then the other moments that we're kind of crafting in rehearsal, we'll spend a lot of time on a moment that we all think is very funny, but then somebody from the outside is like, oh, okay. And then we're like, oh man. So maybe we just wasted that time. But on the other hand, it's what's interesting about comedy, but especially a farce, right? Is that the characters in the play think that everything that's going on is incredibly serious.
Yeah.
Right? It's the situations that are ridiculous, right? So for the characters, this is you know, threatening stuff. This is life or death, do I keep my job or not kind of stuff. But to us on the outside, the situations are so ridiculous that the fact that they're taking them so seriously is what's funny.
I see. Okay, that makes more sense. You are in, when we're speaking, you're in the final moments of preparation here.
That is right, yes.
What's been the most difficult part as you get to the finish line?
I think this is a big show. It's a big show. A lot happens. And there's a lot of technical stuff in the show. And again, I don't want to give away all of it.
Sure.
Because it's you know, spoilers for the story. So all of the things that unfold are very... they require a lot of technical timing and technical work and making sure all of those elements come together. And we're doing a big show in a small theater, in an intimate theater. So you're going to feel like you're right there with all of the craziness that's going on. So that's probably been the most difficult part is envisioning all of these elements that then need to come together.
Well, and I, you know, the saying is that comedy is all about timing, and I guess that probably extends to technical timing
as well. Absolutely, absolutely. And I mean, even if it's a hair off timing wise, or if it, you know, if we don't get the blackout at just the right moment, or if the thing doesn't land where it should when you throw it. I mean, all of these things they affect the way people respond to that moment, right? And there's a ton of surprises in this, and we obviously can't give any of them away. So that's the other thing too, right? Is that it all has to feel incredibly organic.
Yeah, in the moment.
Yeah.
It's happening to the characters.
That's right. But there has to be a lot of planning,
yeah,
you know, in order for those things to be that way. So it's a bit paradoxical in that regard.
Okay. So this is a satire called POTUS about the President of the United States. We were talking a little bit before we sat down. We're in something of a tense political moment.
That's right. Yeah.
How do you bring that in? How do you approach that as you're prepping for this show?
Your friend and mine, Aristotle, wrote this, you know, tiny little book called The Poetics. We only have, you know, some of it is available to us, but he talks about catharsis, right? And catharsis being this emotional release. And one of the best things about a play is that you know, they can be produced multiple times, multiple locations, and it's always alive in that moment, right? So we as an audience bring in our current political climate to the space to see this story, right?
Sure.
And so being able to laugh in the context of that mm-hmm. and realize, you know what? We are all just human beings trying to do our best. And, you know, maybe people who we disagree with, we might disagree with them, but they're also trying to do their best. And so when we can take a step back and kind of laugh at the situation in this play and maybe think about it as it connects to the larger world, that'll give us a little bit of relief. That'll give us a little bit of catharsis.
Wonderful. So anything else we need to know about the show?
Just come ready to laugh. Come ready to have a good time, regardless of what happens. It is definitely for mature audiences.
Okay.
And we are making sure we are super clear about that. It's really because of language and themes and all of that stuff. It's really not intended for anybody under the age of 17.
Okay.
So that's another thing. You know, think about your, I would say it's definitely rated R.
All right. Thank you so much, Jen Blackmore.
Happy to be here.
Ball State's Department of Theater and Dance is an IPR underwriter. I'm Luke Jones.
This week, we're listening back to some of our favorite recent interviews.
Long Haul Paul is a musician and truck driver who told us the creative bursts in his life mostly come after some sort of crash. One of those bursts was his album Floodwaters and Fires. We spoke to him before the album's release in 2024.
We are here today with Paul Marhoefer, also known as Long Haul Paul. He is the husband to Denise and father to Audrey and Anna. Paul is a freelance writer, podcast host, over the road, part-time trucker, and singer-songwriter. Today we are talking with Paul about his new album that is dropping on Thanksgiving Day 2024. Thank you for being here today, Paul.
Yeah, thanks for having us again, Kira. It's always great to come back to this station. I also want to give a shout out to two other siblings that you've not met, our sons John and Jordan, because they'll probably be listening to this.
Please do.
And I don't want them to think they were disowned.
Sorry, John and Jordan. Well, today, can you talk a little bit about how this album came to be and tell us the title of it?
Sure.
I hear there's a bit of intrigue around that.
Well, we were going to call it Highway Prayers, and Billy Strings just released an album on his own called Highway Prayers. It's the hottest bluegrass album since Oh Brother, Where Art Thou? It's number one right now. Well, we can't very well do that. After about our third cup of coffee every morning, we continue to rechristen this album. But everything's going to the CD presser in 2 days, so we're just going to have to pull the trigger on one of them. And how this album came to be was, it seems like a lot of creative bursts in my life, for better or worse, are precipitated by a crash. In April 9th, 2001, I was in a multi-trauma accident, and I broke my neck, and it changed my singing voice. And my brother, speaking of Oh Brother, Where Art Thou, flew down to Miami, and he gave me that CD with one of those EarPod CD players, you know. Do you remember those back in the day? And man, I'm just jacked up on morphine. I've got seven broken bones, and I'm singing my heart out to, you know, these Ralph Stanley songs. And the nurse's assistant walked in, and she goes, "You some kind of rock star?" And I'm kind of liking this broken neck, the way this broken neck is making my voice sound. And I don't recommend any of your listeners undergo that procedure to like launch their late life musical career, but that's what happened. So that's the first crash that precipitated a creative burst. Now, this particular project was precipitated by an incident on Christmas Eve of 2023. I was trying to get home, make it for at least Christmas dinner, and I was in Nebraska, 30 miles east of Ogallala, and all of a sudden, a set of duals came away. Like, so semi-tires have, you know, 18 wheels, mm-hmm. and they're mounted in duals. Well, if you don't grease them properly, or if a tire shop did not tighten the bolts properly, they can come away. So you've got like a 700-pound projectile rolling right at you. And like, I saw it come over the median, and I didn't know what to do. It's like a deer when it decides to like end its life on your grill, and it's boom, that thing hit me. And I came, I was cursing, and I came over the median, see, and now I'm coming right into eastbound traffic.
Wow.
I just thought, I thought I'm certainly going to die. And somehow I didn't. So I spent Christmas Eve in the North Platte Comfort Inn, and all the restaurants were closed, and I got two Kraft mac and cheeses and two popcorns for my Christmas Eve supper. And I sat there, and something just said, any luck getting those gospel songs you wrote 30 years out? And so this is sort of a project of gratitude, because I've been stuck in my head so long wondering, dude, come on, you can't even get through Atlanta rush hour traffic without dropping an F-bomb. People like you do not release gospel albums. But I came to believe, like, this is more about gratitude than whether I meet a standard as a Christian believer. And so this album is a project of gratitude.
Well, and the old English meaning of gospel is good news, and it's real good news that you lived through that to play another day.
Well, thank you. I've been trying to curse a little less and pray a little more since we've been working on this gospel album, and I hope folks like it. I see this as an album that people who don't like gospel music might like. I call this alternative gospel.
Well, can you play something for us? That would be great.
Sure. This is a song I wrote about 14 years ago. My lead guitarist at the time, I had an old trucker band, and my lead guitarist wanted to rewrite one of my songs, and I didn't want him to rewrite one of my songs, and it was like an acrimonious breakup of a trucker garage band. And you would have thought we were like, you know, one of the great rock bands of all time. We had such high hopes. And then I came home, and I got online, and there was that blood red moon over Jerusalem. And I thought maybe it was the moon. You know what I mean? Maybe the moon caused all that. But okay, here we go. I saw the moon over Jerusalem, it was shining blood and red. I think the time's at hand. I think the time's at hand. Back home in Chicago, they were counting up the dead. I think the time's at hand. I think the time's at hand. Gunmen walked in a line, the students in a row. Tell me, are you a Christian? And answer yes or no. Some they stood up cause they knew where they would go. I think the time's at hand. There's a 100-year flood in Charleston rolling past the AME. I think the time's at hand. I think the time's at hand. To bear away the blood of the martyrs to the sea. I think the time's at hand. I think the time's at hand. And I saw the bitter pride of the broken and the poor. whose hands were clenched in fists of rage for the banners they once bore. While the old men waited in the wings and pined away for war. I think the time's at hand. There's a darkness deep down in me. I try to beat it back by day. I think the time's at hand. I think the time's at hand. The nighttime's coming over me and I feel I'm falling away. I think the time's at hand. I think the time's at hand. So I've come to these ruins to take my place among the wrecks, the paupers and the fools, for the wise and strong to vex. Cause there's no one left who's noble and there's nothing I expect. I think the time's at hand. I think the time's at hand. I think the time's at hand. I think the time's at hand.
Thank you. I'm kind of speechless.
That's kind of a dark song, but I mean, it's sort of, I don't know if it's depressing, but I just, yeah, it was right at the breakup of my old trucker band that I wrote that.
I think we can all, like, you know, I was overlaying my own meaning on the song and just feeling intensity, not necessarily depression, but just the intense feelings come through.
So, Muncie, Indiana, circa 1959, when I grew up, nobody said it better than Jason Wilbur, who was John Prine's right-hand man, and he had his own music show on NPR for many years. But he said Indiana, Ohio, these states were really where the Midwest met the South. And we were surrounded by Southern emigres. Who I am musically really stems from one of these specific Southern emigres who came up here. And my father was a well-to-do man. I never inherited his knack for figuring out how to make a dollar, but he had a union meat company, and I would say well over half of his employees were from the South, from Kentucky, Alabama. And we had domestic help. And one of the ladies that worked for my parents became the most important person in my life. She was an unbelievable gospel singer. And when I got my license and whatnot, I became like a groupie of hers. I would follow her to churches. Her name was Harriet Pope, and she was a black woman who worked for my parents a very long time and became also Denise's and my dearest friend. I try to most of my albums have a song which pays tribute to Harriet, and she was like what they call it, a hard shell Baptist, and the traditions among the Baptists, the Southern emigres, that they didn't assimilate into these mainline churches here. They built their own churches and brought their own music, and there were, I've heard people in the churches of Muncie, there's every bit as good as going to the Grand Old Opry, you know what I mean? And they just, and a lot of it was blood harmony, you know, sisters singing together. And that was one of the, you know, one thing I love about Pop of Culture is it celebrates these unseen treasures in our community that you wouldn't notice if you're just living your daily life. And that is one of the unseen treasures of this area, I believe.
There's so many artists and creatives throughout our state who they're doing what they love and they're driven by their creativity and their desire to create.
Yeah, it is. It's surprising when you see just how much talent there is. You know, I used to read this guy called Eric Hofer, and he was known as the Longshoreman Philosopher, and during the Great Depression, he lived on Skid Row in L.A. and just read books voraciously. And then he became a longshoreman during the war. But he made this statement, and it can be applied to any sector of the population. He said, Skid Row is lousy with talent. Mm-hmm. In other words, there's talent everywhere. And I think that the whole thing about Muscle Shoals is someone just built, you know, Rick Hall built a place for people to come to. And there was, I honestly don't believe there's any more talent down there than there is up here. But he gave it a space to blossom.
You're listening to Pop of Culture. I'm Kara Duquette. We're speaking with musician and trucker Long Haul Paul. We've been talking about the inspiration behind his new album that releases Thanksgiving Day, November 28th.
I do want to talk about the process of creating, because you've asked about that. And my songwriting is usually triggered by some trauma, some grievance, some... this one did not make the cut for the album, but we have a dear friend. She was a truck stop waitress for many years in Kentucky, and she called me a few weeks ago from a landline phone, and you know how these newer Apple phones, they'll tell you where they're calling from. And she had been put in a mental institution, and she had lost her son to the opioid addiction crisis, And I have sang this song around the house. Like, look at Denise, like she's shaking her head, like you're not going to sing that song again. But it just made me feel a little bit better, like for her to be seen and heard in this song. And I guess it's a very selfish thing. I write these, you know, that Rick Rubin's got this interesting book out called The Creative Act, I think. And he talks about the law of how the audience comes last, and that seems kind of cold. But if you're not edifying yourself and feeding yourself while you know sing, you can't live that way, or at least I can't. Maybe there's a sector within the music industry that can, but I can't. And
I have to say, you know, creativity that isn't driven by your desire and your internal voice and what you want to express is something else, you know?
Yeah. Oh yeah.
You know, I'm not saying you can't make money at it or whatever, but it's, I don't feel that's,
I mean, I kind of
artistry.
I agree. And I admire people that can write a song and make money. I write jingles for money, and I enjoy that process.
It's not coming deep from your soul.
No, I can. What am I doing there? All right, now we're golden.
All right.
We Yeah, she called me this morning from a landline phone. She said her daughter took and put her in some kind of home. She asked if maybe I might call little Joe and tell him she can't live this way no more. Now her voice, it was heavy from the Thorazine. She said, this coffee that they give me, Paul, it's got no caffeine. Then I thought about that trucker at the 29. He said she lost her son and then she lost her mind. There really wasn't much left for her to do but take to sleeping in her car down at the 22. But I remember when she shined so pretty. They called her Mudflap Girl down at the old fuel city. Dr. Sackler, Dr. Sackler, can you hear me now? Oh, Kentucky, she's breaking like a drunkard's vow. Now there's a new little waitress with her hands up on her hips. Don't you come back around here begging and cutting in my tips. There really wasn't much left for her to do but take to sleeping in her car down at the 22. But I remember when she shined so pretty. They called her Mudflap Girl down at the old fuel city. The sun shines bright on my old Kentucky home. It's summertime and the home folks all are gay. The corn tops are ripe and the meadows in the bloom, and the birds they are singing all the day. Weep no more, my lady. Weep no more today. We will sing one song for my old Kentucky home. My old Kentucky home. My old Kentucky home. My old Kentucky home. Far away.
I really, you know, you singing about this woman and talking about Harriet, talking about your being on the road. I feel like the most important thing in our lives is like when we connect with people and, you know, in different ways and the people we love and spending time and celebrating.
That's my perfect concert. There's a guy in Fountain City who hosts us every year, and it's a carry-in dinner. We try to carry something in, and there's about 30 to 40 people there, and we eat, and then I get up and play, and then we just keep the guitar case open, and it's beats trucking, and it's not like we're turning down stadiums or anything. And it's, you know, nobody here is talking about critical mass. Nobody here is talking about this thing's going to explode any day now. I just got a call from Cracker Barrel. They're going to put my CDs in all their units. This is just a nice thing that makes life better for me, at least. And and I get to hang out with cooler people. I probably never would have gotten to hang out with you folks here at Indiana Public Radio if it weren't for this.
Why, thank you. I think everybody has a different barometer for what their success is, right? And I think ours align, you know?
I've really thought about this a lot lately, and I think success is measured by the amount of time you can spend with the people you care about. And because, you know, if you can never make it home because you're just a slave to debt or something, and you're just right. working all the time, that's real poverty. And I've been there, and where things have loosened up on us a little bit now, and we got to go to a football game yesterday, and we saw some people that we really hadn't seen in a long time, and you know, just got to hug the neck of a man that Denise and I have known for a long time, and that was just such a like it was such a perfect day, you know. Mm-hmm. And we wound up going to Pizza King, and we had a royal feast. You know, the thing about Pizza King, which I don't realize, and maybe you don't realize, but people that leave here and go live some other part of the country, that's what they miss the most about here. And it's hard for me to believe because I sort of take it for granted.
Because it's just right there.
It's just right there.
Well, thank you so much for showering us with riches today. And we are really grateful to have you here.
Oh, thank you so much for having me, Kara. And this is great. Keep up the good work.
Paul Marhoefer, better known as Long Haul Paul, is a musician and trucker. We spoke to him in November of 2024. You're listening to Pop of Culture. I'm Kara Duquette.
And I'm Michelle Kinsey. Every week, we ask an artist, what are you working on?
If you're an artist working on a project, we'd love to hear from you. You can reach the show at indianapublicradio.org/contact and select Pop of Culture.
Recently, we spoke with Sandy Geyer.
Thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you for having me.
Of course. I know that you're an artist and a mom and an equestrian and a horse mom. Mm-hmm. And I wanted you to tell us what you are working on right now.
So as you mentioned, I'm a metalsmith. I work in a lot of media, but I've been mostly focusing on metals for the last like 5 years or so. And I make a lot of objects and also wearable objects. And they are very much inspired by my experience as a caregiver, particularly the mom side of it, but also a little bit of the horse caregiving comes into, which is where I incorporate some of the horse hair into my projects. But most of the objects I make come from a place of either being inspired by the forms of tools of caregiving, or I'm incorporating some of the leftover materials that happen in the acts of caregiving. So like I have pieces made out of candy wrappers that I've fished out of my son's pockets when I do laundry. I have pieces that one of my favorite pieces actually has a little vial with my kids' fingernail clippings in it. So there's a kind of a combination of precious materials and then these leftovers that are basically the trash that comes from caregiving, but putting them together and hopefully making people think about like what is really more valuable and what is precious.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So, and you said you make wearable art. So is this mm-hmm. vial with your child's nails in it a necklace?
So it is, there's a historical form of jewelry called a chatelaine, which when I discovered it, I was like, oh, this is perfect, because the chatelaine is something that modern people might be familiar with if they've watched some historical TV shows like Downton Abbey, because it's usually worn at the waist, and it's traditionally where the keys would be held, so the person who is in charge of the manor would have all the keys, and so symbolically it represents like access and power, and I just thought it would be sort of amusing to combine it with the very unglamorous tasks that you do if you are this person who is in charge of taking care of everything.
Nice. Can you talk a little bit about some more of the items of care that mm-hmm. you use? Because it's really making me start to think about what that could possibly mean.
Mm-hmm. So I mentioned the nail care chatelaine. So the, mm-hmm. the vial collecting the fingernails is just one component of it. It also has some other chains that hang off. And so it has like a little container for the nail clippers themselves. And so the idea is if I always had this kind of, you know, on my purse, then it would be very easy to, when I noticed that my kids needed their nails trimmed, to go ahead and trim it and then collect it. And then I also have, this one is actually for my horse. It's a, I don't know if you ever heard of a Victorian a hair catcher. So they would have these jars and it would have a hole in the lid. And so after they brushed their hair, they would take the hair out of the hairbrush and kind of stuff it in this jar. And when they had enough, they would use it to make sort of like a little... like an accessory that they could use to put back in their hair and like add volume and kind of like bump their hair up. So
the jar?
Not the jar. It was just the, just so the jar was for collecting the hair. And then, yeah, and then they would kind of use that hair to create the piece that would lift their hairstyle up.
Wow.
So I made one of those, but it clips to my belt. And then when I'm brushing my pony, especially in the springtime, he sheds a lot. And so I would just have these handfuls of hair and I would just be stuffing them into this little jar. And then when it gets condensed and I open it up, it's almost like a little nest of hair that it creates. And those were kind of interesting little forms, again, made of trash. But
well, and is it, you know, I feel like you've transformed things from trash to art.
I hope so. Yeah, it seems like if it was just trash, I would be able to throw it away, but I just can't seem to, so.
Yeah, I like the idea of using things that you would ordinarily cast off mm-hmm. as functional. The idea of having the clippers right at the ready. Mm-hmm, is yeah. there any other things like that you have that you wear on your person and you utilize in another way?
Let's see. I'm trying to think of like another finished object. So I have, this is also in the form of chatelaine, but it is a little dustpan and broom, and the chain that holds them together is of cast Cheerios that I have picked up on the floor from underneath where my children eat their breakfast, because there is always a lot of material there for me to collect. So I took the Cheerios and I cast them in bronze and I made it into a chain. And so now that is the part that keeps the components together for my little dustpan chatelaine.
That's fabulous. Can you talk a little bit about the horsehair and what you've made with that? And what's your horse's name?
Sure. Okay. So his name is Eeyore. That's his barn name. And his name was Eeyore when I got him. And it's so perfect. It suits him. Like, he's just like, okay, I'll do whatever. But when he was doing occasional shows, his show name was Thanks for Noticing. And so I've had him for longer than I've had children. And so I've been taking care of him for, I think I've had him for 18 years now. And he has a very long, beautiful, wavy mane. And so when I would comb his mane, the comb would be full of his hair. So I felt like I didn't want to throw away what I should be throwing away after I finished brushing him. So I was just collecting these piles of hair. And then was able to start incorporating it into my work and doing some weaving with other materials like metal wire, and then weaving the horsehair as well and kind of combining them in different ways. And I liked the way the horsehair is a little bit less easy to control, and the wire, I can kind of put it where it belongs and it stays there. So I get this kind of balance of order and chaos.
Nice. You've had your horse longer than your children. Mm-hmm. I just want to know, like, how old your children are now, and do you feel as if your art is evolving as they evolve in terms of the care, or what does it look like now?
Yes. So the pony I've had for 18 years, and then my oldest child is 12. So I have a 12-year-old boy, and then I have an 8-year-old girl. And I think the sorts of things that I'm getting from them that I'm using in the art is definitely changing as they get older, because I also have some pieces that I've made with like their drawings, because I don't know, I think maybe a lot of parents have this experience where their kids are very prolific creators, and so your yes. house is just, like, sometimes I come home and my whole floor is just covered in drawings, and again, they're all precious, you can't just scoop them up and throw them away, at least not when your kids are watching, so that has changed a little bit, like, as my kids get older, and I think they're a little bit more discerning now with their art too. Like, they don't necessarily show me everything that they draw, because when they're little, they're so proud of everything. And then when they get older, it's like they kind of do a self filter where they're like, they'll show you the really good stuff, but I want to see it all. And so I have been making some pieces that are out of enamel, which is like fused glass on metal, but using my kids' drawings as the design for that. So that way, even if the papers don't last forever, I have this little, I usually turn them into brooches again. Yes, yeah, so I can wear them and just remind me of when they were a little bit younger. So I think having these objects, it helps me to kind of remember some of these moments that maybe don't get as much recognition in the moment. But when you think back, you're like, yes, that was a very important memory.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And then you have captured it in some way.
Exactly.
Well, can you tell us where we could find your work?
Sure. I have an Instagram account where I post a lot of my work, and then a lot of some of my times my students' work as well, because I do teach art. And that is at Coppermare. That's my handle on Instagram. And website incoming soon, I hope.
Nice. So we appreciate you being here today, and it was very lovely to speak with you.
Thank you so much.
All right, Michelle, let's talk about some things going on this weekend.
I'm ready.
Great. The BSU Studio Band with special guest Sophia Vaughn will perform at Be Here Now in the Village Friday, February 21st. The show begins at 8 p.m.
Air Supply will perform at Old National Center in Indy Saturday, February 22nd. The Soft Rock begins at 7:30 p.m. The duo, get this, Kara, is celebrating 50 years of music.
I'm all out of love.
I'm so lost without you.
All aboard for the train show at the Delaware County Fairgrounds on Saturday, February 22nd. Did you know that this is Indiana's largest and longest running single day train show?
What?
It's true. The show has been chugging along for 33 years. Explore model train displays, shop a wide variety of model trains and accessories, and connect with the local train loving community from 10 a.m. to 3 p.m.
The Ball State Symphony Orchestra will perform Thursday, February 27th at Sursa Performance Hall. This performance will feature the Ball State Chamber Choir.
The Nozeal Brass Jubilee will also perform Thursday, February 27th on the Ball State campus. This show will be at Emmons Auditorium. The Austrian band, known as the Monty Python of the music world, seamlessly combines slapstick comedy with musical ability. Ooh.
Now that is something, I'm picturing it in my head right now, and I think that is going to be a lot of fun. The new exhibit, People and Places, 1873 to 2000, opened this week at the David Owsley Museum of Art, featuring a selection of photographs from DOMA's collection curated by Ron Brown. The exhibit continues through May 23rd. Ron Brown, born in Portland, Indiana, followed a career path as a photographer for the television and film industry to Hollywood. This exhibition displays images from the history of photography that focuses on capturing the subject's personality through gesture, facial expression, and setting. I love seeing pieces from DOMA's collection. I love when they are brought out of storage and put on display in new and unique ways.
Oh, yeah. There is so much there.
Mm-hmm.
The Indianapolis Symphony Orchestra is presenting Star Wars, A New Hope, in concert Friday through Sunday, February 21st through 23rd, at the Hilbert Circle Theater. The screening of this Star Wars epic will feature the score performed live by the ISO musicians. May the Force be with them. Arrive early and you can have your photo taken with Star Wars characters in the lobby. IndianapolisSymphony.org has details.
Fun that will be. If you have a far out event Pop of Culture listeners need to know about, tell us at indianapublicradio.org/contact, then select Pop of Culture.
Pop of Culture on IPR is made possible in part by Psi Iota Xi. Additional support comes from the Indiana Arts Commission, the Community Foundation of Randolph County, the National Endowment for the Arts, and sustaining members of IPR. You can support local programming today at indianapublicradio.org.
And that's our show. This episode was produced by Luke Jones, who finds catharsis in satire
and all forms of pastry. And was hosted by me, Kara Duquette.
And me, Michelle Kinsey. Pop of Culture is a production of IPR on the campus of Ball State University.